evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for coming out. And I want to thank Libby for coming to see us again. It's been a long time. Libby and I have a long history together because we have published some of her novels. And she...
The very first chapter in the first novel, An Eye for Murder, that you published, right, takes place during World War II.
That's true.
And then I really
you circled back, haven't you?
After 20 years.
I know, because you had written one about the Vietnam War. You've written a whole number of things.
A Bend in the River.
Right. How many books did we do in that first series? I don't remember now.
Five.
Okay.
You did five.
And they took place, some of them, around the North Shore of Chicago, which is where I grew up. So that was kind of fun to do those.
Yeah, and then there was the bridge. I didn't know anything about publishing at the time, and she was trying to think of, she actually thought of the cover for this first book. And she says, well, you know, there's a bridge. You know, the Chicago has lots of bridges, and she said, there's this bridge in Prague that, you know, and the first chapter takes place in Prague. And she says, go find me some images. She says, go find me some images. Huh?
Right, it's a really beautiful bridge, very famous bridge, but it was a beautiful
bridge. I think
there was a beautiful cover for the book, but what we learn in commercial publishing is that beautiful covers are not necessarily the way to go. But anyway, here you are. So tell me a little bit about you. Are you publishing these? You've incorporated yourself. What are you doing?
Yes, I'm publishing them by myself. At least the historicals. I didn't know I was that much of a type A.
Why not?
Exactly.
Well, you learned a lot.
I learned a lot over the course. And I knew that I could do it in a professional way that would look like it was professionally published. A lot because of Barbara, a lot because of other people that I've worked with. And it's a lot of work, though.
It's a huge amount of work, no question.
Yeah. And then you still have all of the promotion and the marketing afterwards. If I could just write and then publish, I'd be really happy. But then there's this whole other half.
What? Even major authors with big publishing companies increasingly have to do all their own social media and marketing. Right. So, you know, you wouldn't be saving yourself that much if you were being published by, you know, Hachette or Simon & Schuster or something. You'd still be here, you know, doing this kind of thing. It's hard to make a splash in a very crowded marketplace. And
it seems to be getting more crowded every
day. It is. The number of publications has gone up. This will be a surprising statistic to you guys. But there are roughly 1,700 new books published every week. And of that, almost 300 on average, somewhere between 260 and 290 usually, are adult hardcover fiction. Tremendous children's market. Despite all the banned books, there is a tremendous children's book market. I mean, maybe they're not being sold in every market, but nonetheless, huge. The consequence of all that it's harder and harder to get attention, but it's also true that there are only five major publishers now, the big guys in New York. That once upon a time, there were a whole bunch of them. But because they're so big, they're leaving room for lots of small publishers to start mushrooming up. So aren't we seeing that, Patrick, that we are increasingly getting supplies, you know, from other places? So, you know, Libby, you're not really unique in all this.
No, even if I was lucky that I had somewhat of a following.
Right. But, you know, to do it yourself, it's almost impossible to do it from scratch.
Right.
So you did have an audience, and that made it simpler, you know, to build upon. So this book, tell us about Max's War, because you're right. We're back before World War II.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, we're in Regensburg, which is one of the cities in Germany that, totally by accident, I've spent a lot of time in.
No kidding.
Well, and the reason is that I signed up to go on a Northwestern University alumni trip down the Danube. And it started in Regensburg and went to Budapest. Right. But the problem was it was in the spring and the river rose. And there is a bridge just south of Passau. That's iron. and the boat captain was not paying attention and discovered too late that he could not get his riverboat under this Iron Railroad Bridge. And so I got to spend three surprising days in Regensburg, which, you know, and it had one of the best museums, that medieval museums that I have been in.
It's a UNESCO site. Right?
I think so.
It was designated a UNESCO site.
I think so.
Anyway, the idea for this book started a long time ago. My late father-in-law was in the OSS. He was he was off the boat in 1939 from Germany. He'd gotten out. He was the sole survivor of his family. He was in Philadelphia, and he got drafted after the U.S. entered the war. But he was not sent to basic training. He was sent directly up to Canada to Camp X with Wild Bill Donovan and the man that wrote Intrepid, Stevenson. What's his name? Stevenson. And he was trained to be an OSS person because he was German and he knew the German culture beautifully. And they had just started this program to send German draftees, or those who enlisted, back behind enemy lines to ferret out German troop movements and to try to capture POWs, which they did. And then he was to interrogate them after they were caught. And that's exactly what the Ritchie Boys did. And this book is about a Ritchie Boy. It's fiction, but it is grounded in all of the research which I've done, and I have a funny story I'll tell you afterwards about this. But it starts in 1932, right after Hitler comes to power. A young boy in Germany is 12 years old, and little by little, the noose of persecution wraps around the heads and the necks of Jewish people in Germany, and it gets worse and worse and worse. So the family decides he was raised in affluence. He had his own horse and carriage, and so did my late father-in-law. So they decided they were going to flee to Holland, because Holland was known as a very tolerant country, and they were, Jews had assimilated there, and people were pretty friendly. So they go to Holland, and this is the only, he's now about 15 or so, and this is the only normal time he had. And then a couple of years later, Hitler invades Holland. He got to the U.S. His parents refused to go. This is real life as well as in the book. And 2 years later, in 1942, the parents were rounded up and taken to Sobibor and gassed. But he was in the U.S. And then he, once he finds out that his parents were taken away, he enlists. And again, he's German, he knows the culture, and he is sent to Camp Ritchie, which was the U.S. Army's first coordinated intel program ever. And it's in Maryland. It's 600 acres of beautiful mountains and farmland. And it was an amazing place because they were given everything they needed. They kind of improvised. They said, well, we need this class, and we need this class. And then when they realized, no, that class isn't working out. What we really need is something on disguises. We really need something on Morse code. We really need something on the structure of the German army, so our guys know as much as they possibly could. And the Defense Department gave them, or it was the War Department in those days, gave them everything that they needed. And it was, you know, it was the most unbureaucratic that the Army has probably ever been, you know, because it was pretty loose. It's all gone now. But what happened was they recruited 2,300 German immigrants. That's not all. They had Italians there. They had Russians. They had Polish people there. They had, they even had some Japanese people there who had been in the U.S., but still had ties to their old country.
Well, but it's more than that. They were natural language speakers. You know, it would sound authentic. And, you know, they would look because there are, you know, physiological, you know, characteristics of a lot of groups. So basically they wanted to send people that wouldn't stand out. You know, the Germans tried to send spies into Britain during the war, and there were some really hilarious moments where they would expose themselves by, for example, walking into a pub and demanding coffee or something, you know. I mean, stuff that, you know, you needed to know how things worked if you were going to go back and be a spy. And so it was really a very interesting program.
Yeah, and they knew, and the immigrants knew the sports situation in Germany, and they knew who was big in Hollywood, not Hollywood, although they did love Hollywood, the Germans loved Hollywood films. So it was things like that. They really did do a lot of really of good work. In fact, the statistics say that 60% of the German troop movements on the ground, not in the air, but in the on the ground, were the result of Richie Boy intel. So they had the what is what they compare to an undergraduate education in 10 weeks. And then many of them went on for advanced training, which happens in my book. Max is recruited by the OSS. And there were the OSS and the Ritchie Boys were kind of cousins. They were kind of like kissing cousins. They did missions together. They shared some classes together. And they knew each other. They knew of each other. And so Max does a couple of really interesting missions with the OSS. Then by that time, the U.S. has geared up, and they've got, you know, people in Europe, and D-Day has been planned, and Max is called back to the Ritchie Boys to become an interrogator when after on D-Day. And then also Battle of the Bulge after D-Day. I learned a lot about battles. I knew nothing. Yeah. I knew absolutely nothing. And the other thing I didn't know anything about was, you know, when people mention the Holocaust, we all have this very uncomfortable feeling. We'd rather change the subject. You know, we don't want to talk about it. But how many of us really know exactly what Germany and Hitler and the Nazis did? In terms of legislation and in terms of laws that really caused all of the uproar. And a lot of it was Goebbels. It was Goebbels putting in his word, his propaganda. So in the first part of the book, when they're still in Germany, I detail all the laws that were passed. And it gets kind of uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable for me to write them. But
have you actually been to see? I mean, I've been to a whole bunch of them.
No.
Not active, but, you know, when I was there, that Theresienstadt is not that far from Prague, I think it is. They're really horrific places, and they've left them there as a reminder of what it was like. But they didn't necessarily start by killing everybody. I mean, a lot of this was economic because, you know, the Jewish population had a lot of assets, so that was part of it.
Right, and Germany was in the middle of an economic mess.
Well, there's a new book coming out by Graham Moore, who I'm happy to say is coming here on May 20th, that talks about the war. The German war machine was built to get them out of the disaster that the Treaty of Versailles caused, the impoverishment of Germany. And his thesis, which I think is true, is that the economy was set up only to run as a wartime economy. And that's why Germany invaded Russia. And they were basically, if they ever stopped fighting, making war, their whole economy would collapse again. So they had this, because, you know, if you think about it, it didn't make any sense for them to invade Russia. It made no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, the economic basis of it required them to do that.
And when the wartime economy started to improve and people had money and they had jobs again, the people just loved Hitler because he was putting money back in their pockets. Yeah, it was all making armaments and making tanks and things like that, but they loved him. And so, you know, they were...
Yeah, but the other side of the playbook is that people like that always are looking for some way to focus resentment, blame, whatever it might be, envy, We're seeing that right now with the immigration issue. I mean, it's just the German playbook or the Hitler playbook all over again.
Yeah, it is.
It's very
scary.
Much so.
It's very scary. Sure. Yes, yes. There were about 2,300 that were Jewish. And that's how the name Richie Boy developed, was just to apply to those. But now that all of the information has been declassified, there were about 20,000 altogether who went through Camp Richie. There were about 5,200 that went through the undergraduate program. So the Jews were about half of that, and then there were, what I was telling you, the Poles, the Russians, the Italians were the other half. And they had similar programs, and when they could, they were all together, but a lot of it was because of what country they were going to be going to and what they were going to be doing.
Particular danger going back behind it.
Very.
Yes, but they were also going to be less sympathetic to the Germans, because if you know, I grew up in Chicago, like Libby. Well, I don't know if you grew up there, but anyway, we did. But, you know, there were very strong German populations in Missouri and Wisconsin and all, and a great tendency to want to do what we did to the Japanese, to intern them, because, you know, they could be disloyal. So if you had a displaced Jewish population that was not going to be sympathetic to the Jew, they would be actually ideal spies to send back, very, very not likely to turn, you know, and be double agents again.
So,
did you find that to be true, by the way? Or did I just make that up?
No, you didn't make it up. You never make anything.
It seems logical, but, you know, I don't know that I could prove it, but it just seems as though that would be a normal thing to do.
I was looking for some numbers, and I found them. There were 2,300 that were German, 2,872, 326 Italians, 2,000 in the dozens of other languages spoken, which included Russian, Greek, Norwegian, Polish, and Arabic, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, the Baghdadi Jews. Did you, in this book, I had never heard of them before. There's a whole different branch of Judaism that I'm Jewish, but I never knew that they were from Aleppo and Syria and the Middle East, and they were taken over by Germans, too. And then there was Shanghai. There's Shanghai's in the book. Max is German. Okay, so we'll get to the characters a little bit. Max has a German friend, a young girl who's his age, and they sort of become boyfriend and girlfriend, but then her parents take her family to Shanghai, and he goes to Holland. And when he's in Holland, he absolutely falls in love with this girl, and is besotted with her. And he keeps up a correspondence with Renee throughout the 10 or 15 years that they haven't seen each other. But she finds someone else, she gets engaged, she's supposed to get married. But then things do change. I can't tell you any more. But
No. No, I always read the end of the book first.
Oh, you do?
Oh,
my goodness.
I read the first chapter. Oh. I have anxiety about outcome.
I can understand. With mysteries, I can understand that, or
yes.
With thrillers.
Even
yeah.
Difficult.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's a problem.
No, it's not a problem. It's just the way you read.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's nothing. Actually, you'll like the end of Libby's book, so.
Yeah.
Despite all the awful things that happen to people on the way.
Patrick was asking me if I had an idea for a sequel, and I have an idea for a short story that I like writing short stories because they kind of are like seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm writing a short story and it works, I can say, well, what if we just broaden that out, and maybe so I have an idea of the McCarthy period. Give them 10 years of peace, and then see what happens when McCarthy comes
another
up.
Another truly terrible time in the history of our democracy, right?
But we did have, America did have those 10 years of peace beforehand, or even more, no, 8.
Even in the wartime, there were American fascists, there were, you know, immigrant groups. I didn't realize, I've only, back to Graham Moore's book, that there was a group of Southerners in the State Department who were fascist. A man named Bradford Long, I think his name is, who actually hid memos about the terrible conditions of the concentration camps and all, and didn't want to grant visas. He turned away the ship, you know, the famous ship that...
The St. Louis.
Yep, with 900 people that Cuba refused, because America was trying desperately to stay new, not just us, but all of South and North America wanted to stay neutral in the war. They wanted to treat it as Europe's war, because we hadn't even recovered from World War One. And it was... You do know that Germany, we never did declare war on Germany. You know, they declared war on us as a preemptive strike. And I grew up assuming, you know, that we, after Pearl Harbor, went ahead and did, but we didn't. And many scholars think that that was sort of like Hitler's last mistake, is it's not entirely clear that we would have declared war on Germany. We might have just focused on the Pacific War. But he decided that he would, you know... Might as well.
Did you have Rachel Maddow here at all?
She was here in town. Yeah.
She wrote a book about the American fascists of the 1930s.
Right.
It's called Prequel. It's called Prequel.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Right. Yeah. But the St. Louis was a tragic incident because there were, I think, like 900 Jewish refugees, and Cuba wouldn't let them into port because of this neutrality thing. And when they came here, Bradford Long, apparently, you know, and the visa people turned them away. They sailed back to Hamburg, and probably terrible things happened to them after that.
It did. They ended up, some in Belgium, some in Holland, some in the UK, but the ones in Belgium and Holland were all taken away. So,
what's called The Voyage of the Damned.
Oh, is that okay?
It's a book by, was it Luis Correa or somebody like that?
Yeah. So I did enormous amounts of research for this book, and I love doing research. That's the only reason I was able to write it, is because I had so much research that I was able to create scenes based on something I'd learned in the research. And it all kind of just fell together very smoothly at the end. So I didn't expect the nice reception it's gotten so far. And I hope it continues to get a good reception.
So you haven't really talked about the fact that before he was a Ritchie boy, you have quite a lot of background about what it was like for him and his family in the 1930s. I mean, he doesn't get to be a Ritchie boy until halfway through this book.
Right.
So I thought you did a great job. I thought you did a good job laying the groundwork for who he was and the situation.
I knew that younger readers particularly weren't going to have any idea of what happened in Germany and Nazi Germany before the war started. So that was one of the reasons. But it was also for his character, because you had to understand why he already had trauma. You know, his fear, his uncertainty, his rage. You know, and so that's why that part of it was so extended.
Love story, right, yeah. Which is also, because the book is a love story, too. It isn't just all, you know.
A lot of stuff.
Did your father-in-law have diaries or letters? No, he
wouldn't talk about it. He would not talk about it at all. Over the years, a few anecdotes came out, and they are all in the book, all the ones that we know of. They're all there. The way he got out of, got to the ship in Rotterdam in the truck, that was apparently true. The way that in the Battle of the Bulge, there is a screw up in scheduling, and someone takes Max's place and is killed. And so that, you know, that doesn't really spoil it, because you won't. You'll still enjoy the scene, I think. And then there's another chapter that I'm not going to tell you about, I'm not going to tell you about a lot of it.
Clearly survival was to a great degree luck. You know, people who'd write wrong place, wrong time, or, you know, some intervening thing.
So I am not a historian, and I don't pretend to be one. But when I read what happened at the Battle of the Bulge, you know, I had always heard, oh, we won the Battle of the Bulge, and that was what the end of it was. Sheer luck. It was the weather. the weather was, the weather.
You know, that's 1066 and all that, too. Don't forget, you know, if the comet hadn't come along, the Normans probably couldn't have conquered England. It's amazing how stuff like that, you know, happens.
It's the myths of, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, but when I really started researching what happened, the Americans were losing the Battle of the Bulge. They had not anticipated that Germany was going to have that many troops. And this was Germany's last stand, and everybody knew it. And they were really, but they had troops that had not been trained properly. They had troops that they had just kind of like Russia was doing with Ukraine, just shoving them in there. And so there were a lot of heads and soldiers, but they didn't know what they were doing. But the weather was so cold. It was December, and it was rainy, and it was snowing, and it was overcast for like 4 or 5 days. So the air support couldn't get in to help the Americans, and they were in pretty bad shape. And then all of a sudden the weather cleared and the air support came in and everything was fine. Do you know there's a man, and I now live in a condo, I downsized, and in a condo, there's a man who is about to turn 100, and he was a bombardier in World War II. And he's still all there, sharp as a tack. I interviewed him for the book. Yeah, yeah, that was amazing, amazing guy.
He's, you know where he is?
Yeah, he's in Chicago.
Oh, in Chicago.
Yeah, he's in Chicago.
I live in Oregon most of the time, and there's a gentleman in Bend, Oregon, that's not quite 100. That
was in World War II?
Yeah, I mean, there's very...
Very few.
There are very few left at this point. No, it's absolutely true. So I have an interesting footnote to all of this. When you were talking about... them going to Holland. I just read a book because I'd run out of everything else, and my husband was reading it, so I took it away from him, called The Weight of Ink, which won the National Jewish Book Award. It's a phenomenal book. I don't know if you've read it, but if you haven't, you should. And it takes place, it's a two-track story, but it basically takes place in 1650 up through the Great Fire, the Plague and the Great Fire, and then the modern story takes place in 2000. But what I didn't know is that the place that the Sephardic Jews went to escape the Inquisition was Holland, because Holland had broken away at that point from Catholic Spain, and therefore it was a place where was a very large Jewish community. And in this book, there are few rabbis and other Jews who want to move to England, because the Jews have been expelled from England in 12 whatever it was, and only in this time period Oliver Cromwell decided to let some of the Jews come back. He was looking for, you know, extra support. Mm-hmm. And so there was a migration of some rabbis and some members of the Jewish community in Holland to England. And, you know, I had, yeah, so I didn't realize that Holland was actually a place of refuge for European Jews.
Just like Shanghai was. Later on.
It was the only port that would actually take them. But, of course, the bad news was when they went to Shanghai, nobody thought about the Japanese. So you were not better off in... Well, you were better off in Shanghai than in Germany.
They did not kill
the Japanese.
Jews.
Did not go after the Jews. That's right.
Taking, putting them in a ghetto, and it was a slum, and it was horrible. And a lot of people died just because they got sick.
Joseph Cannon will be here on June, what is it, Patrick, the 24th, I think it is. And his book is, in fact, about that. It's set in Shanghai, and it is about Jewish refugees going to. And S.J. Rosen wrote a book several years ago, quite a while back, also about Jews going to Shanghai.
Right. Well, it was good for first few. If you got there early, it was fine. But then after the Japanese came in, it was...
Well, everybody was looking at Europe and didn't really anticipate the sort of blitzkrieg that Japan, to borrow a word, Japan was going to exercise in Asia. One of my favorite stories, I just learned this, you will like this. There's a book written by a Malaysian woman that came out in January. And it is, in fact, about Malaysia in the 1930s, and a Malaysian woman who really resented the British and the way that the Malaysians were treated as compared to the British colonials and all. And she formed a liaison with a Japanese general and gave him, this is a true story actually, based on the novel, and gave him information. And the information she gave him was that all the British defenses were seapointing because the British were a naval power, right? So do you know how the Japanese invaded Malaysia? On bicycles. Seriously, they rode bicycles in because all the weapons, everything else was heading at, you know, pointed at ships arriving. And I mean, this is, you know, you would think that we would know more about these smaller stories.
They have bicycles at Camp Ritchie.
That's right.
They train soldiers to ride bicycles.
Yep. That's why.
That's why.
Yep.
Oh, it's not funny.
But I mean, I find it fascinating that, you know, here we are 80 some years later, and we're only now finding out about some things about this war.
Yeah.
That, you know,
absolutely.
Everyone had a story. Everybody had a story.
That's the story I was telling Patrick before. You know, I used to say, well, why world, you know, people would say, well, why World War II? Well, because it was the last real battle of good versus evil. But that's a little superficial.
It was so global.
Exactly.
And that is what it involves so many people. I mean, there's a whole vogue right at the moment for telling women's stories. I was really happy to read Max's work, reading about a guy, because I have read so many books
about, you
know, women's. I mean, it's the woman bookseller and the woman librarian and the woman, just endless women's stories. Were you?
We were just talking about the same thing.
Exactly.
Before.
Well, publishing tends to do that. You know, there's one success. And then, you know, they all rush to sort of, get into that deal. But I was really very pleased to be reading about Max as compared to, you know.
Thank you. One little point about Shanghai.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Patrick.
Shanghai was a huge, it was the biggest city in China. It was the most cosmopolitan. It was the most Western. It kind of looked like Chicago to me because there was the water in the front and then the buildings, high-rise buildings in the back, right next to the water. But there was a huge opium trade in China, and it came through Shanghai. And the Baghdadi Jews, who were the ones that I was telling you about, they had the corner on the business side of it. So a lot of them were not the best.
Well, the British brought the opium to China so that they could take home the porcelain and the silk and the tea was the primary thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, the more you look back over history, it's economics. It's whatever. I mean, I was talking to David Baldacci, my earlier event tonight, and Patrick and I were, and we were talking about, you know, the Civil War was basically the plantation economy, which required free labor, i.e. slaves, versus the industrial North that did not. And then, you know, if you really look back, most of the time, wars are really fought about economies.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I was advanced history when I was a senior in high school, and we had a wonderful teacher who was teaching us about the theories, different theories of history. And our final exam was we had to decide how we thought history. I'm with you. I said it's all about economics.
It's usually about economics, and I also embrace the great man theory of history because most of the time if there's a really tremendous crisis, there does arise a person who can lead you out of it. We were so incredibly lucky in George Washington, for example, who didn't want to be a king and who actually went and resigned his generalship. You know, if you go to Annapolis, there's a whole thing that you can do there about, you know, George saying, you know, okay, you know, won the war, been, you know, I'm going home. And then he had two terms of office, right? And then he went back to Mount Vernon, or, you know, we got Lincoln. And oddly enough, and I came from a wildly Republican family who hated Harry Truman, not for any reason I could ever discern. We were incredibly lucky to have Truman because, you know, he looked like he was not up to the job. He didn't have any real experience. He'd been kept in the dark, you know, by Roosevelt the whole bit. And yet, you know, when push came to shove, he stood up. And, you know, that's what we need.
What
again.
A choice he had. Oh, boy, what a decision he had.
He was incredibly
courageous.
Not so much that, but he was so pragmatic that he was able to make a choice and not be haunted by it, because many people asked him afterward, you know, but think about it, the Marshall Plan, you know, I mean, leaving around, you know, mm-hmm. Hiroshima, that isn't what I was really thinking about. I was thinking about the rebuilding programs.
Yes.
And, you know, all of that. And he was able to.
We did that with Japan, too. I mean.
Yeah, MacArthur went back to Japan and, you know, basically built it up again.
Right.
But we learned, I think that we did learn that punishing Germany so severely after the First World War was not a good thing to do.
That's right.
You know, breaking their economy and humiliating them is what led it.
That's one of the few instances where I can say that we actually learned from history.
Right.
Because
mostly
most
we don't. And right now we're not. We're forgetting it. Right.
Right. Right, exactly.
You're reinventing the wheel.
Pardon me?
I feel like it.
Yeah.
Fallen back into the whole world, sort of the 1930s. But, you know, in this country, we are moving backwards while people all around us think about it. Think about abortion. Mexico is, you know, Ireland, you know, Spain, these incredibly Catholic countries and all have all accepted. Our Supreme Court today decided that the 1864 law was going to hold
1864.
Up. I could hardly believe it. So, and here's the thing. I mean, David and I mentioned this. Our Supreme Court in Arizona said, no, you know, abortion is not going to be legal because of the 1864 law. Now, there is a whole group here that wants to put the abortion issue on the ballot. They probably will get to do that. And that, does that mean that the voters get to override the Arizona Supreme Court? Well, I do too. But my point is, you know, how does this work if everything is temporary? You know, if the court says it'll be this and then the voters say it'll be that. And so you can't really count on anything to be settled the way things are at the moment.
'64. Yeah. And so I have a profile of him and reading about him, and he married a 15-year-old. And I mean, that were, anyway.
Of course, one of the questions is, why are we letting men decide this issue for us? But that's another whole question. But anyway, I think I just wonder what we're thinking, because we are going backwards while everybody else is moving forwards, and I don't really quite understand it.
I have faith that it's going to revert back to normal.
Okay, please.
I hope so. I thought it was settled in 2020, but I was mistaken.
I mean, despite writing about really tragic things and evil, I still am somewhat Pollyanna-ish.
Well, you found, I haven't read the book, but you found the heroic in the tragedy.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the optimism and the hope comes from.
Yeah, it's true. Because I couldn't live in a world that didn't have hope. So, anyway. And Max still had a little bit of hope. He was very stable, you know. He didn't let himself get flustered too much about what was going on. He was too busy trying to stay alive, actually. So,
and grateful, you know. I mean, I think anybody who survived the war had to be grateful.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have kind of a silly question, but I'm curious about the cover. I did think of that too.
Who is that gorgeous guy?
Okay.
I've had an inquiry already about the film rights, but we'll see. I made the cover with AI.
No.
What's that?
Artificial intelligence.
You mean he's not a real guy?
He's not a real guy.
He's not real.
Okay, this is, I'm having so much fun. There are two graphics AI programs. One is called Midjourney, and the other one is Microsoft. It's anyway. So if you can't find what I did prior to the book coming out, and you can see it on my Instagram page. I did a lot of custom-made images, AI images, and of scenes from the book. And then I had I have a couple sentences, text from the book to go with them. And when we did that cover, we had his head, and I said, "This is perfect. He doesn't look Jewish. He, you know, whatever, and he can pass as an Aryan." But he had on a jacket, a military jacket, that signaled he was a corporal, a colonel, because he had all these badges, and I looked it up, and we can't have him. You know, somebody's going to write me and say, what is he doing being a colonel? So I shopped around to find a lieutenant's jacket. And even then, we had to strip. My designer had to strip all of the lapels and the badges and things off of the jacket, so it's really plain. There's nothing on the jacket, but I said that Max would have liked it that way because he liked to pat. You know, he wanted to be. He didn't want to be noticed. So we married the head of the guy that you see with the jacket that was stripped, and that's Max.
You did an excellent job.
Well, thank you.
Obviously.
Actually, my favorite part of the cover, and it's really hard, you have to see it up close, is a map of Europe spelled out with the cities. Yeah, you'll see that on the bottom. On the bottom.
I like the lighting behind.
Thank you. Yeah, I know. It just it was very just well like done. That. Yeah, thank you.
Paris is over here, and then
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good for something, is what you're saying.
Huh? AI is good for something. That didn't come from AI. That was just a map that he found that was not copyrighted, so we could use it. AI is not.
AI's big problem is when it runs into copyrighted material, but that's not really the case here. So
it was one of the reasons I also stripped the jacket, so I didn't want anything on the jacket that people could see.
Do you ever have an editor?
Yes. I always hire. Well, it's on me. It's not on. It's not on the publisher. So I pay, you know, a good. But I would never publish a book without having an editor. And that's another thing that I learned. You know, if you're going to do it, you have to do it right. She was my editor for a long time.
I beat her up, so she remembers how it all was. Now,
well, she was.
Poison
she was
Pen
when
Press,
she published.
Which we sold it in 2019, but we had it for 20 years and. So I probably edited somewhere between 800 and 900 books, and it was a wonderful exercise. I really enjoyed it,
I
miss it. But the store's gotten a lot busier, and I really couldn't keep it up. But my husband was the publisher, and he said, and you know, so we were getting close to 80, that he didn't really want to put any more money or any more time into something that it deserved better than we could do. So we sold it to another publisher who has done, and this, I'm trying to remember, I just looked at the New York Times paperback list and 3 Poison Pen Press titles are on it, which never would have happened while we had it. You know, it went to, went to Source Books, which is now owned 53% by Random House. So, you know, eventually
it's
our little publishing company is going to be part of Random House. It is part of Random House. Who knew? You know, and unfortunately, a lot of the authors that we published them because they weren't bestseller material. You know, we like the smaller stories and other stuff. And so many of them aren't being published anymore, but some survived, and then they brought in new authors. But anyway, when you see Poison Pen Press, that was originally us, but isn't now. But in the process, Libby and I did a bunch of work together.
Yeah, she's a good editor.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yes.
I do college counseling, and I call myself the spin doctor. I've been doing it for about 25 years, and so I work with kids on their essays and scholarships and all of that. So now, reading experiences, I'm editing. I try not to, so I wonder, do you do that? Do you edit while you're reading? Do you do that?
Well, sometimes, but one of the most annoying things that an author can run into is a reader who wants the story to be different, right, Patrick? I mean, there have been some really interesting incidents, and we occasionally we hear them here in the store, don't we? Where, you know, the author, I mean, the book's done, guys, you know, it's out there and it's published.
It's finished.
And then, you know, readers will say, you know, but why didn't you do so-and-so, or it should have gone that way. So while I think everybody has their own version of the story, if you're a good editor, you try to let the author's version of the story be the version that comes out. But what, well, it's not so much that. It's less about, although I'm a grammar policeman, but most of the time, it would either the author had said too much and you needed to trim it back because it would read better, or the author, I can't remember how many times I had this conversation, probably hundreds of times, when I would say, so what happened here? And the author would tell me, and then I would say, well, but you didn't write that down. It's not in the book. And so a lot of it was putting in things that needed to be there and taking out things that didn't need to be there. And that's why, Libby, we'll say you need a first reader, who, you know, not yourself or even ideally anybody truly connected to you, who can say, you know, here's where you need to add stuff, or here's where you need to explain things or whatever, and here's all the stuff that has to be cut. What did Don say that Sonny made it ended up cutting out of The Power of the Dog?
It was like 2,000
page manuscript. Oh my God.
600 or something, right? And they sat up in his kitchen for at least one or two nights and ruthlessly cut the book. And the reason it was so long was Don had done all of his research, and he just couldn't bear to leave it out, right? And so, you know, so it's a judgment call about how much material. That's the danger of writing, you know, of research is, you know.
But for, they do say that of all the research you do, only 10% of it ends up in the finished book. This is more, this one, I would say 30% of my research ended up in the book. And the good thing about doing research is it gave me ideas for scenes. And I could take something that actually happened and I could fashion a scene with Max or with some of the other soldiers or what happened in Germany. So I love doing research because it helps me. It helps me get the.
But that's another decision you have to make in historical fiction. Are you basing it on real people, or, you know, how much of it is real events and how much of it are you, you know, just making
up? I towed the line. It really is real events. But at the last minute, I changed the names of the officers at Camp Ritchie. Just because I said, you know what, I better change it just a little bit, just in case somebody had a problem with the way I described one of the real top officers. So I did.
Yeah, well, but that comes up even writing contemporary fiction. You know, if you want to kill somebody in a restaurant, you have to really think about whether you want it to be a real restaurant or a pretend restaurant. You know, so, I mean, those decisions come up all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
Do you all have any other questions that you'd like to ask?
Thank you.
It's a very gripping book. Once you start it, you really want to power right through it.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed
it, and I did. So this is the first time I've seen the finished book, because what Libby sent me was a typescript because she didn't have them.
Yeah.
So I the cover thing came as a complete surprise to me. You know.
So yeah.
And I see why you were so taken with it, because he does have an appeal, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
And that's unfortunately packaging.
The only man in my life. He's the only man in my life.
Sorry to hear that.
Are you on to the next, or are you taking a break?
I'm taking a break until some of the promotion and the signings are over, and then I've got to decide whether I want to go forward with this or go back to my series. I have two crime fiction series with female protagonists that are contemporary, six books in each. So, and they're been waiting. They've been waiting very patiently to have me come back and do something else with them. So, I don't know. I could use a little lighter fare. You know, give me a good murder instead of a world war.
Do you do as much research in those?
You do different kind of research, yes, but not quite this much. But a lot on police procedure and a lot on how things work and fingerprints and how someone would find a clue, and is it realistic, is it authentic, could it really happen, that kind of thing.
Unfortunately, it's all getting so technological that to write an authentic contemporary crime novel, you really have to, it's a lot more work than it was when Raymond Chandler went out and walked down that, you know. What was your question, Patrick? You just made one.
Set the night on fire.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, it was the first historical that I wrote, and it's about a young woman who, in the present, who's being stalked by someone who's trying to kill her, and she doesn't know who, and she doesn't know why. And in her search to find out who, she finds out that her parents were not the people that she thought they were. And her parents turn out to be hippie radical activists from the late 60s. And the story goes back to them, and it pretty much stays there until the very end.
That was a radical time, 1968. We were talking about that, all the things that happened, you know, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, the Democratic Convention. What else? The Tet Offensive, you know, disillusionment with the war. I mean, there were the presidential election. There were many, many things in play
Watergate.
In 1968.
But we didn't know about Watergate till later.
No.
Yeah.
Were you in Chicago when all that was?
No, I was in D.C. though, and I was there.
Oh yeah.
Oh wow. I was in college. I was supposed to. My boyfriend at the time had a job with the Robert Kennedy campaign. He was going to be in charge of the youth for Kennedy. And when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, I just said, that's it. I'm out. So.
Another seminal moment. We'll never know how it would have gone. The Kennedys were, you know, a tragic family. And I don't have, you know, it's hard to know whether Bobby could have been elected or what kind of president he would have been. He was actually the brains, most of it, under JFK, you know, and so I think he would have been a good president.
I think he would have too. He got much more compassionate as after Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. He was just, you know, something clicked in him, and he.
I hope there's not an afterlife, because if he could see what his son is doing, he'd probably be revolving in his grave. You know, I mean,
I know.
I don't what kooky thing he did something today. I can't remember what. I don't know where he came from.
I will say he wrote a book about his cousin, Michael.
The murder suspect.
Yeah, murder suspect, and he exonerated him in the book, and it was very well done. And so I thought that in that book was kind
we'll
of like the young Bobby, the Robert Kennedy Jr. that I would have liked to have seen more of. But then he went back to his stuff, crazy stuff. Anyway.
Who knows what trauma has done to him. So,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know.
We'll
see.
You
were mentioning that group of Jews who came to Mexico.
Oh, that's during the McCarthy. Well, yeah, in the 30s. A bunch of very liberal, some were communists, some were not, some were Jews, some were not. They all went to Mexico to get away from the what was going on in the United States and stayed there through the McCarthy years. I don't know. I know a woman who was the daughter of a couple that was in the crowd wrote a book. And I read the book because I thought I was going to write about the Jews in Mexico, but I didn't.
I mean, were they in Mexico?
Mexico City.
Oh, they were.
And then there was a place near Mexico City that's more of an artist's colony, and they were there too. But I.
No,
it could have been. Senior moment.
Yeah.
Mexico wasn't the drug cartels, and it wasn't quite as dangerous, I think, then.
Yeah, no, it wasn't at all.
As now, I think you'd have to be pretty brave to go to Mexico now.
Yeah, I'm sure they're all gone.
That's Don Winslow, if you really want to read about that, The Power of the Dog. And wasn't there a sequel?
Two
more, right? It was a oh, that's right. Okay, so Don did really, really extensive research into all that.
I'm reading his book, with the woman that he loves, the character that he loves, and they move from Mexico back to, because he's taking a job with the DEA. Which one? Which is his character is taking? Anyway.
Isn't that Power of the Dog?
I think so.
Yeah, Don Winslow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forget the name of it.
No, she just didn't remember which in the trilogy, but I think it was Power of the Dog, yeah.
Maybe.
But he spent 3 years researching that book, which is why it was 2,000 pages reduced to 600 and some, right?
Right.
Yeah, indeed. Well, thank you very much for coming,
yes.
ladies.
And thank you all for tuning in. Thank you very much,
virtual audience, for joining us. Were there any questions from the virtual audience? All right,
good.
Well, read them out.
Can I take them
Are we still? Are we still?
Yeah. We're
recording?
Still on.
Okay.
Yeah. There were some good comments that came through. Liz mentions. She says Woodrow Wilson, who had many flaws, nevertheless saw that the Treaty of Versailles would be a guarantee of another big war. Let's see. Yeah, he tried to prevent the Versailles Treaty.
Yeah.
Let's see. There was just a question that which you've partially answered, which was just how long did it take you to write the book, you know, once you had the research all in place?
Not that long. Not that long. Not about a year, you know, a little less than a year. I started in January and I finished last November.
How quickly did you keep to your father-in-law's story? Stick to
pretty
it.
Well.
Pretty well.
Well, there was a lot I didn't know, so I had to fill in the gaps with what I thought would be good a good story. But the anecdotes are all in there, the ones that I knew of.
So any chance of taking him onto the next, like a post-war adventure?
Possibly.
Possibly.
I have a short story in mind.
That's what you were saying.
Yeah, and so I'll try that and see if it works.
Right.
Let's see. Right. Never know. But thank you.
Yeah. A lot of people watching.
Great.
Yep.
Thank you all for tuning in and watching. I know it's late on the East Coast, so I really appreciate it.
The last thing, someone was just wondering, what is the name of the 68 set book called?
Set the Night on Fire.
Set the Night on Fire.
Yes, and we actually... Huh? Yes, it's still available. It's still on Amazon and on other retail outlets, and you can order it from Ingram if you want. And we got permission to use those lyrics from the people that owned the lyrics, not the song, but the lyrics for The Doors, Light My Fire. Yeah, there's only 6 lines in the entire song, and it's true. And we were able to get them and use them. And I was a very small publisher, and I really didn't have any money. So they just... And they're very careful. And if they catch you, ooh,
yes,
but they only asked for $100.
Wow.
I said, that I can afford.
Yeah.
What do you know the lyrics? Something about you know that I would be untrue.
True.
Something a liar.
Liar. If I did tell you, girl, we couldn't go no higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire.
Repeat.
Okay, we could all sing it together.
Love it. Oh, all right, on that high note, thank you all very much for watching. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.